he will be joining the meeting later. My name is Sigile Masiko. I am the acting chairperson for the Portfolio Committee of Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities. Our Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Ncube Ndaba, has a family bereavement and she is unable to join the meeting. Let me, Honourable Members, officially welcome you to the meeting. I have noted from the list of members present that we have Honourable Members from the Portfolio Committee of Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities, Honourable Members from the Portfolio Committee of Justice, as well as the Minister and Deputy Ministers that have been invited. I can see the Deputy the Minister for Police, as well as the Deputy Minister for Police. I was also informed that the Deputy Minister for Justice will be joining the meeting. We've also got government officials from the Department of Justice, the Department of Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities, as well as the Department of... can you just remind me, Neliswa?
Good day, Chair. It's the Department of Police.
Okay, the Department of Police. You are welcome, Honourable Members, Ministers and Deputy Ministers, as well as the officials from the various government departments, as well as our support team from Parliament. We have honourable members during the period of the 16 days of activism, of which we know that the theme for this year is the year of Umama uCharlotte Manye Maxeke, 16 days of activism, moving from awareness to accountability. And that is where we are currently in terms of accountability, where we need to take stock of the progress that has been made in relation to the implementation of a government, what we would call, excuse me, government's bold plan to eradicate gender-based violence and femicide. And that is the implementation of the National Strategic Plan on Gender-Based Violence and Femicide. And we know that currently, from many corners or various corners of the country, there is a voice of concern which seeks to say that some of the pillars of the NSP are being implemented at a snail's pace. We have then invited the various government departments who are key role players in the implementation of the NSP to come forth during this period and give us a progress on the implementation of the NSP. We've also noted with concern, Honourable Members, that during the time or the period of COVID-19, there has been a hindrance in the implementation of the NSP. With the rising numbers of gender-based violence cases that have continued during the pandemic. In terms of the crime stats, we've noted also with concern that there is a reported increase with more than 10,000 people who were reported to be raped in South Africa between the period of April and June 2021. We've also noted, Honourable Members, that in terms of the responsibilities of Parliament, critical legislation designated to improve access to justice for victims of gender-based violence has been a work in progress. You know that we have the Domestic Violence Amendment Act, Amendment Bill, the Criminals Matter Amendment Bill, which speaks to bail and sentencing, as well as the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Bill, which are still under consideration by the National Council of Provinces. We've also had and noted with concern that although in our police station there have been AMA evidence collection kits, a backlog on domestic violence and sexual offences cases has increased. We are therefore here, Honourable Members, to deal with the progress, engage the various government departments on the progress towards the implementation of the NSP. I have noted the presence and attendance of the chairperson for the Portfolio Committee of Police. You are welcome, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable members, we will then take the next item, which is item two, on our agenda. After the you've been welcomed, I will request the Secretary of the Committee to give us the apologies that have been submitted in writing to her office. Nelistwa.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to members, ministers, and the support staff. I have received the following apologies. One is from the Minister of Women, Youth, and Persons with Disabilities, who's out of the country due to official business. Two, I've received an apology from Honorable Shlongo, who's attending public hearings of the Portfolio Committee on Social Development. Honorable Sondo also will not be able to attend due bereavement in the family. And the last one is from Honorable Ntlangwini, indicated that she will leave at 12 p.m. The other two I have received from the Portfolio Committee on Police, two apologies from Honorable Dr. Greenwald and Honorable Sheikh Imam. Those are the two from the Portfolio Committee on Police. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Kashifa. Thank you very much, Nelly. I see the hands of Honorable Member Tanguini, as well as Honorable Member, the Chairperson, Tina Juma Peterson, in that order.
Morning, members. Morning, Honorable Masuka. No, I'm fine. I just wanted to raise my early departure. I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Chair.
Morning, Honorable Chairperson. Greetings to you. Greetings to the ministers and the deputy ministers and the committee members of the three committees. Thank you very much for convening this meeting. We have the two members which you indicated have been booked off ill until next year. We have our minister and our deputy minister. Our national commissioner is attending the inquiry, the commission of inquiry, but we are very well represented in terms of SAPS. I'm also requesting that you do allow our minister to leave. But our deputy minister will remain throughout the proceedings. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. The request is granted, as we appreciate the presence and attendance of SAPS in the meeting together with the minister and deputy ministers. It really does show a great support, level of support towards the cause itself. We greatly appreciate the presence and the request for early departure of the minister has been noted and is granted, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you very much. Honorable members.
My apologies, Chair. I've also received an apology of our whip, Honorable Siabi. My apologies for that.
Okay, noted, Honorable Chair. Thank you very much. Honorable Sharif.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, colleagues. Just wanted to find out what time the Honourable Minister will be leaving. Will it be before or after the presentation? Thank you, Chair.
Okay, can we get a response? Honourable Chair?
Chairperson, I will get an indication from the Minister and I'll let you know. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let us then proceed, Honourable Members, to our next agenda item. We will receive a presentation from the Department of Justice and Correctional Services on the progress made on the implementation of the NSP on gender-based violence and femicide. I will hand over to the Department of Justice and Correctional Services. I do understand that the team is led by the ministry. If the deputy minister is present, I will hand over to the deputy minister, who will then introduce the team and hand over to the official present. Over to you, Honorable Deputy Minister.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and good morning to all the members. I'm joined by Advocate Praise Kambula, the Chief Director for Vulnerable Groups, who is the person who reports from Department of Justice to the Presidency on the implementation of the NSP. And then also Advocate Tandeka Lujiza, who's in Constitutional Chief Director in Constitutional Development. I had asked the Chair, I had spoken to the Chair about the fact, I mean the actual Chair, not the acting Chair, Honourable Masiko, that I also be allowed to leave at about 10:45. I'm already committed to a function which is relevant to this gathering, which is a celebration at the Khayelitsha Magistrates Court about it having all the facilities necessary for it to be a sexual offences court. So that was a prior commitment. But Chair, if there is a presentation which, if it can be loaded, and which Advocate Kambula will take us through, maybe while that is happening. So I don't know, Advocate Kambula, are you? You'd sent, I think that the presentation was sent through last night. I don't know if the committee section have got it. Advocate Kambula?
I believe it was sent to DM, and Fuzo is in here to respond.
Okay, if the presentation can just be loaded, I just had one thing to say while that was happening. Is it Mbuso? Have you got it?
I am still printing. Must I do from?
I printed it, but I was printing from the USB. This one
is up. It's being loaded now. Thanks. Just Chair or Acting Chair and members, just to correct one thing in the input.
If we can CMS.
Maybe the committee section could switch their mic off.
Can you mute his mic, please? He's disturbing the meeting. Thank you very much. Apologies for that, Deputy Minister. You may proceed.
Thanks. Just to say, this is from the department. There's three departments in the under the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services. It's Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, Department of Correctional Services, and the Office of the Chief Justice. This, as you would see from the presentation, is from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, which is the lead department in the cluster, really relating to the implementation of the NSP. So just to give that context. Also, Acting Chair, the three gender-based violence bills have been passed by the National Assembly earlier this year. They are with the President for assent. There is a delay in terms of the constitution, or concerns were raised by a member of the public on the constitutionality of the Sexual Offences Amendment Bill. So that has delayed things a bit as far as the assent to all three bills whilst those concerns are considered. But having said that, if I could hand over to Advocate Kambula.
Thank you, DM, and thank you, Chair. And we appreciate this opportunity as a department to come and give then our outputs in terms of the implementation of the NSP. We will be reporting then on all the achievements made by the department during the first year of the implementation of the NSP, and would like then to bring to the committee the fact that it was the implementation of the NSP commenced, unfortunately, during a very difficult time for the country and for the whole world. But within those constraints and the restrictions, we managed to deliver in some of the indicators that we have in the NSP. Would you please just take me to the next slide? So this is actually just the presentation at a glance. As I have said, that we will be just be targeting those milestones that have been achieved from each pillar. If you can take me to the next slide. This is just the overview then of the NSP pillars, and I believe that all the departments who have been invited will be dealing with all, but I would like just to bring it to the attention of the chair that the Department of Justice is taking a leadership in the implementation of many of the indicators that are in pillar three. And I am also then the chairperson and the convener for the NSP Pillar 3 committee. Thank you. If you can take us to the next slide. So Pillar 1 is dealing, of course, with accountability, coordination, and leadership. And this is, if you can take me to the next slide. Now, let me just try to remove this. It is blocking my view. Okay, good. With our milestones, as we know that the first indicator in this pillar, it places then the responsibility on the department to assist then with the drafting of the bill for the National GBVF Council. This is what the department did, and we forwarded then the draft then to the Department of Women, and giving them, you know, the baseline approach on how the whole concept should be approached. And of course, then we took the responsibility of amending the certain pieces of legislation, particularly the Domestic Violence, the Criminal Law and Related Matters Amendment Act, as well as, so these are the three bills that were introduced by the minister into parliament, and that was in August 2020. So if you look at these bills, they have clauses that speak to accountability, because if you go to the Presidential Summit Declaration, Article 1 and Article 2 of the Presidential Summit Declaration, they speak then to the issues of accountability, that every person living in South Africa must take the responsibility of ending gender-based violence and femicide. So then the aspirations of these two articles then were incorporated into the three bills that were introduced into Parliament. If you look at the first one, the Criminal Law, Sexual Offences and Related Amendment Act, Amendment Bill, it places a legal obligation on certain persons, including the employees, the employers, licensing authorities, as well as the applicants for fostering, kinship, caregiving, adoption, to be first vetted before they can get those licenses, and also for those then who are seeking employment at the places that will be making them to be exposed, to have that direct exposure to children and persons with disabilities, so as to be vetted. And the department started with the vetting process then in 2019 and moving on further. Then we also have then the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill, which also incorporates the clauses that speak to accountability. It has one then that says that the functionaries and also the other person might have the obligation to report a domestic violence perpetrated against children and persons with mental disabilities, as well as older person. So what it means is that we have then these pieces of these bills that speak against a bystanderism in matters that relate then to domestic violence to domestic violence. And also there's also another clause then within the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill that says that all the key stakeholders must develop national directives with disciplinary measures against non-compliance, meaning that then if there is a person who is at the service point who does not, who probably treats a person with secondary exposes a victim to secondary traumatization, that should be visited with a disciplinary measure. And then we also have then the Criminal Law and Related Matters Amendment Bill. It also incorporates accountability clauses. And one of them is that the prosecutors need then to place on record the reasons for not opposing a bail application in respect of any offense that has been committed against a person who is in a domestic relationship with the accused. If you can take me to the next slide. So, Chairperson, with these bills, then the department was demonstrating then its response to Pillar 1 of the NSP. Now, coming then to us as a department, responding to one of the indicators of Pillar 1 to ensure that then we bridge the gap in gender parity in the employment space. Our magistrate, the female magistrate, as you know, that the department was employing a huge number of magistrates recently. So now we have female magistrates that have reached 51.6%. And also then our SMS female personnel within the department are still standing at 47, which and then we have the female judges, then that they've reached 43%, 43.7%. And these figures, Chairperson, are not, they show the commitment of the department in ensuring that we have women then in those positions of authority and seniority. As you know, that from our country, we're coming from a country, from a political dispensation where then we were seeing less of women occupying those positions. So these numbers then are the demonstration and then of that commitment by the department to bridge the gap. If you can take me to the next slide. So now I will be taking the committee to our outputs in terms of Pillar 2 that deals with prevention, restoration of social fabric. If you can take me to the next slide. So this pillar has one indicator which is led by the department, which is rapid response mechanisms to respond to incidents of racist and xenophobic offenses and hate crimes. And the key activity there is titled Implementation of the National Action Plan to Combat Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. So I would like first just to say to the committee that the National Action Plan with its five-year program of action was approved by Cabinet on the 27th of February 2019. And also then the Cabinet also approved the documents that were deposited with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. And that was done, of course, via DECO, and that was in July 2019, just to show then the country's commitment towards combating racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related tolerance. Then this indicator then requires the department to put together a rapid response mechanism. And this is what we have done. a rapid response mechanism task team has been set up, and it has the representation of the different government departments that are relevant to this subject, and also includes then the chapter 9 institutions and the relevant civil society organizations. So the task team then has moved further than to draft the terms of reference for this task team, and recently a consultative stakeholder engagement was held, that is on the 24th of November, where then the draft TOR was endorsed, and also then all the members of the task team were also identified and also endorsed. So the other baselines, the other milestones that have been achieved in terms of this indicator, there's a baseline study report that has been developed, which is intended to determine the current status of discrimination in our country. And also then it is a document that will also be serving then as a guiding tool in the implementation of the mandate of the rapid response mechanism at task team. And also, there is a public education strategy on anti-discrimination that has also been developed so as to increase then the levels of tolerance in matters that relate then to racism, to xenophobia, and also to racial discrimination. If you can take me to the next slide. So indicator number two of this key deliverable, then it also key intervention, it also then requires the department to put together a virtual data repository on disaggregated statistical data for measurement of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. This is a matter that the department has already started working on. As I have said, Chairperson, that we are still at the first year of the implementation, now moving to the second year of the implementation of the NSP. So now the team has already met with all the stakeholders that are relevant, including the civil society, to identify the data sets that should form part of this repository. So and the members of this task team include, of course, the HSRC and also the StatsSA and other technical experts. So these data sets then will include disaggregated data on gender, race, age, and also the research interventions, so as to ensure that we have a portal that also looks into the interventions and also the administrative, so as to assist then the country to do the administrative analysis and also to provide those outputs that will be helping us then to sharpen our response in issues that relate then to combating racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and also the related intolerance. If you can take me to the next slide. Now, this one is the second key intervention on this pillar that talks then to harnessing approaches to prevention that facilitate integration and deepen impact. So the department is here. As you know that we have our deputy minister who is chairing then the task team on issues that relate then to LGBTQIA+, and which has the full representation of civil society and the departments that are relevant to this matter. So now, with the coming in of the NSP, so the National Intervention Strategy that was developed by this task team had to be aligned then with the GBVF NSP. And this is an exercise that has been done. So the National Intervention Strategy that speaks then to SOGI was then aligned with the GBVF NSP to incorporate in that strategy the indicators that speak then to matters that related to SOGI programs. And also recently, that is on the 5th to the 4th to the 5th of November 2020, 2021, then there was the EU South African policy dialogue on the rights of transgender and intersex persons, which focused then on issues that relate to the legal framework. Are there any gaps in the legal framework in terms of the protection of the rights of the LGBTQIA plus persons, and also looking into those violations. And we had then our honorable minister then giving an address in this dialogue. This is just to show the commitment of the department in ensuring that we achieve the aspirations of the NSP. There's also then the prevention, as you know, that the prevention and combating of the hate crimes and hate speech bill that the department then worked on. It is before Parliament, and Parliament will be deliberating on it in 2022. If you can take me to the next slide. Now, if you go to Pillar 2 also then has an indicator that speaks then to all government departments and to participate then in the implementation of the 365 days campaign against the GBVF. As a department, despite the fact that there were restrictions that we had, the COVID-19 restrictions, that is in 2020, we did not slow down. We went through, we developed a campaign that took us then to us delivering 102 interventions during that period. And we took advantage then of the social media platforms so as to communicate then to people. As you know, that during the hard lockdowns, we were informed of the rising figures of GBVF in certain sectors. So then we had to roll up our sleeves as a department to ensure that then we communicate. So as you will see there, so these are the interventions that we have had, and they are covering all areas. And also I would like also to bring it to the committee that we also have what we call the under the tree dialogues, which are focusing on men. As we know that with the issues of GBVF, if we do not then put our energies on men and also on boys, then we'll be missing the point in terms of bringing down the levels of offending in GBVF. So we have that program that we do out of the radio stations, and also we had also the content dialogues during the low level of lockdown, and also having then those Facebook chats for men and so on. I would also like to say then to the chairperson that the department, in partnership with GCIS, we have what we call the Let's Talk Justice, which is a multilingual radio talk show that is aired then to over 70 national and community radio stations. I think that there's a mic that is opened. And also then we have also those webinars that we were holding on the 3GBV bills so as to popularize them, and also on the rights of older persons and persons with disabilities. And then there were also those interviews that, you know, were led by our political leaders, interviews by hosted then by a number of sorry, chairperson, there's a disturbance on my side. If you can take me to the next slide. Now I will be taking you then to Pillar 3. Pillar 3, as I said, that this is one of the pillars where the department has got a volume of the indicators that it must take leadership on. If you can take me to the next slide. So with this one, then As you know, that from the emergency response action plan, we were requested by the women who marched and the report that was coming from the summit on gender-based violence and femicide, the presidential summit on gender-based violence, that the minister should be putting together the regulations that related to sexual offences courts. This was done, and our minister approved the regulations relating to sexual offences courts. And this an embodiment of the support services that must be provided then to victims of sexual offences when they enter the criminal justice system, but particularly the court system. And our minister then moved on then to just to make then the regulations then to be easy to implement. National guidelines for the establishment of the sexual offences courts were developed and also approved by the minister. And there was a task team that was set by the department, which included the judiciary, Legal Aid South Africa, as well as the civil society. And I would also like to say that with the regulations relating to sexual offences courts, we have regulations that allow then the civil society organization to come in and assist then the court system to ensure that we have a caring court system that respects the dignity of the survivors who enter into the system, that is victim-centric. So they are coming in as court supporters to provide then those services. So what it means is then it takes the approach then of the presidential summit declaration that places then that responsibility on everyone living in South Africa to ensure that you contribute then in eliminating then the incidence of gender-based violence and femicide. So it takes that collective approach and that multi-sectoral approach in ensuring that we have a court system that is victim-centric. Then also then now, we have moved now, as we know that the Section 55 capital A of the Criminal Law, Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act was promulgated in February 2020, which is a provision, Chairperson, that creates then the statutory sexual offences courts. It recognises the sexual offences courts. So now we are in a process then of finalising the designation of the courts for the establishment of about 100 courts, Section 55 capital A, as sexual offences courts that will be that will be fully compliant with the regulations relating to sexual offences courts, that then also look into the needs of older persons, of persons with disabilities as they are entering into our court system. We also, during the lockdowns, the different lockdowns of 2020, we introduced then the domestic violence SMS notification system that bridges the communication gap between the court system and the applicants for the protection orders. So this is a system that is already operational in many of our district courts. And as I have said, is to ensure that then the complainants who have entered into our system then are updated of the case developments. And as we know that with the bill, the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill also has a clause that requires the establishment of the online applications for protection orders. So the department did not wait then for Parliament to approve the bills. We started during 2020 to develop the online web portal for domestic violence applications for protection orders, which is then intended to ensure that then the applicants are able then to reach the system at the places of safety. So now it's going to be possible for a victim to make an application online at her house without coming to court, because some of them do not want to come to court because of the issues of the fear of the unknown, the fear of intimidation, the fear of embarrassment, and there's also a huge ambivalence that they also experience that makes them, then many of them, to be discouraged to enter into the system. With this online application, we hope that we're going to be having an increase then in the reporting of these cases. And now the online web portal is in the process now of being integrated with our e-judicial workspace and also the integrated case management system, so as to ensure that then all the stakeholders that are responsible, that participate in applications for protection orders, are operating in one space.
Advocate Kambula, can you go a little bit faster, because you've still got to allow time for questions and answers.
All right, thank you, DM. We also then held 130 sessions. I'm sorry, we had the trauma debriefing sessions for our intermediaries, interpreters, and also stenographers during 2020-2021. And I would also like to say that then, as we are expected then to clear the backlog cases and matters that relate to GBVF, we introduced during the COVID financial year, the 100 days rapid response initiative. And we cleared a lot of domestic violence matters that were pending in our courts. And these are the figures as you are seeing them in this slide. And we also introduced the same in bringing down the divorce backlog cases. We piloted this project in 14 courts that are in Limpopo. And within 100 days, 824 divorce backlog cases were finalized. If you can take me to the next slide. So now we have incorporated this project in the DDM project. And this then the slide then it shows then the conviction rate in these cases. If you compare 2020, 2019, 2020, 2020, and 2021, that then the conviction rate in sexual offenses, it increased from 75.2 to 75.8. If you can take me to the next slide. So we also then, as pillar three, we finalized then the phase three of the Femicide Watch, which is a national repository for the gender-based violence related femicide cases. So as a country, we'll have that portal where all these cases of femicide then are analyzed for the purpose of ensuring that as a country we improve our response in matters that relate to femicide. So as I will not talk then about the three bills that were introduced into Parliament, which we also then we are taking as an achievement in terms of implementing Pillar 3. So as you know that the Cyber Crimes Act, it commenced with its implementation on the 1st of December 2020. And we have a number of bills there, the recognition of the Customary Marriages Amendment Act, which was assented to on the 26th May 2020. If you can see that the department in terms of improving the legislation so as to incorporate then the clauses of the Presidential Summit Declaration, that it moved with agility. And we also then process then the NRSO clearance certificates and the applications and issued 1,835 clearance certificates. If you can take me to the next slide. Now, this is the one that deals with response, care, support, and healing. So, Chairperson, if you look then at all, these are the support services that are incorporated in the regulations relating to sexual offences at court, and this is the model that we will be taking progressively to incorporate it at the service point for domestic violence. So it's got a lot of support services, as you are seeing them, that we have also improved our information services and made them to be accessible to persons with mental disabilities. Private waiting room, language interpretation services, and private testifying services, and also the post-trial and emotional containment service, witness fees, and so on. So it's a whole package, a basket of support services that are intended then to make our court system victim-centric. If you can take me to the next slide. So we have also then developed, that is in 2020, we developed the national strategy on the universal access for persons with disabilities. So as to ensure that then we have a disability-centric court system. Now in 2020, in this financial year, we developed the minimum standards from that strategy. And it's got a package and a basket of support services for persons with disabilities, the court users with disabilities that enter into our court system. So we in every court now, we're saying that there should be a register that is for the ad hoc to provide then the ad hoc sign language interpreters. As you see that it's got services to provide physical accessibility and also demarcated areas also for the guide dogs and also for the court accompanying the persons, educational information that is in braille, large print, easy read format, pictorial graphics, and also the audio material. And we have also then enforced, because these the minimum standards, we are progressively introducing this basket of support services in all our district courts. And for this financial year, our target is 75. And thus far, we have managed then to upgrade 40, and we are left then with those few that we are working very hard in terms of upgrading them so that they are compliant with the minimum standard. We developed the headings guides, which are for the training then of the frontline officials, so as to understand then the needs of the persons with disabilities as they enter into our court system. If you can take me to the next slide. Five that deals with economic empowerment. Take me to the next slide. So we have an indicator here as a department that talks to maintenance, the Maintenance Act. So this is what we have done. We develop a maintenance defaulter strategy, which then is intended to track and trace all those defaulters. And it's a project that is moving with so much speed, so as to ensure that then we eliminate the system of all defaulters. And there's also the online application for maintenance orders that has also been piloted. It is being piloted now in KZN, so as to ensure that then our women are able then to make the applications for protection orders from their home settings and places of safety. And we also introduced the SMS notification system, which is now in implementation in some of the courts. And this was done in 2020 during the COVID year. We also introduced then the program, which is to speed up then the finalization of the maintenance applications within 90 days. It is moving also with some momentum, gathering momentum in terms of the implementation. If you can take me to the next slide. Now, which is the last pillar, which deals with research and information systems. There is some work that has been done here, Chairperson, by the department. You can take me to the next slide. First, then, this is it has one indicator that the department is participating in, which is establishing the integrated GBVF management information system across government and justice system. So what we have done, we finalized, sorry, Chairperson, it's not phase four, it's phase three. We are now in this financial year working on developing phase four of the femicide watch. So we are taking in a phased-in approach towards the establishment of the femicide watch. And I would like to say that we are the first country in Africa and one of the few in the whole world that have introduced the femicide watch in their countries. As I have said, that it is a national repository of all these cases that relate to femicide. So as to help within the country to channel the resources for intervention where they are mostly needed. So we also then finalize, we receive the task from the government stakeholders that as a department, we should be developing the national prevention strategy against femicide. So we have a draft already, which takes a rudimentary approach to the issues of femicide. As you know that in the country, we don't have a document that speaks to femicide. So this is gonna be the very first. So then it defines a femicide, it comes up with the different types of femicide that are aligned to the social context of the country and also comes up with interventions for the entire country. It takes a multidisciplinary approach to the intervention, and it has already been adopted by the NSP pillar collaborators. So this is just one of the issues that we have done. I think this now, it takes me to the end of the presentation to say that in the midst of all the challenges that we had, these are the deliverables that we came up with, but also to say that, of course, then there are challenges that the department experienced. As you know, that the issues of resources and that we experience the issues of the intersectoral engagements and so those are the challenges that we experience. But then in the midst of all that, then those are the deliverables that we have achieved. Thank you so much, Chairperson. It brings me to the end of the presentation.
Thank you very much, Advocate Kambula. Thank you, DM, and your team for the presentation. We have received it quite well. I will request honorable members to jot down their comments as well as the questions they have on the presentation that we have just received. Earlier on in the meeting, we had been notified that the Minister for Police will request to be excused in the meeting earlier. So we will request honorable members that you allow us to receive the presentation from the Department of Police on the progress on the NSP, so as to allow the minister to be excused quite early in the meeting. I see the hand of Honorable Sharif.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanna just maybe flag it that the Deputy Minister for Justice said that he too has to leave. And so I think perhaps he wanted us to ask the questions before he leaves, because he did say he has another engagement happening right now.
Okay, maybe let us take one set of hands, Honorable Sharif, because the Honorable Minister Tele is going to leave the meeting at 11. So we are only left with 30 minutes to deal with the presentation from SAPS. I will allow...
Maybe, Chair.
Yes, Honorable Reed.
Can we check with the Deputy Minister what time he needs to leave? Because I think your first suggestion is really proper, that we get the two presentations made
together and discuss them together. Honorable... Okay.
Chair, unfortunately, I have to leave at 10:45. Honourable Janki, it's to you weren't there when I spoke. It's a celebration at the Khayelitsha Magistrates Court because they've now got the facilities for a sexual offences court. You may want to join me.
At last, yes, I may.
Okay, honourable members, let us just take one set of hands for the Department of Justice and Correctional Services, And then should there be any other hands that wish to ask questions, we'll have to take them at the end so that we give enough time as well to police to make the presentations before the minister leaves. I will then recognize the hands that wish to pose any questions on the presentation from Justice. I see only one hand, honorable members, and that is the hand of Honorable Sharif. Are there any other hands? Okay, there being none, let me also, honorable members, I had noted at the beginning of the meeting that we had an apology from honorable chairperson of Justice, honorable member Makwanishe, was going to join the meeting late. He has now officially joined the meeting, and we would welcome the honorable chairperson to the meeting. Honorable Sharif, you may proceed and ask your question or make comments on the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll be very quick because I know time is an issue. The first one is, how does Justice engage with the CGE on court monitoring reports? Because as you know, CGE monitors cases that go to court. As well as, how do you engage with the CGE on cases that are open across the country by the CGE and the legal clinic that the CGE currently has? How does the relationship work? Chair, there's another question. Rights of transgender and intersex persons that was held on the 4th to the 1st of November. Can you please give us a little bit more information, especially looking at what sort of legal framework the department is looking at? And then can I also have more information on the femicide watch and just more information on that, what did phase one and phase two include, because we only know about phase three and phase four, and what will it look like at the end, or how is it envisioned to look like? And then my last question is, all the time when departments come and report to committees, they only speak about the great stories and all the fairy dust and the butterflies, but they don't tell us what's really happening and what is the challenges they're facing, what is the risk mitigation strategies, and how do we look at interventions and see if they're working, if they're not working, so that we can come up with new ideas for things that may not be working. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sharif. Honorable DM, I'll hand over to you and your team to respond.
Yeah, maybe if Advocate Kambule briefly can deal with the issue of the femicide watch and whether she has any knowledge of the relationship with the CGE.
Thank you, DM. We built a relationship with CGE, I think, to move with them in partnership in terms of the interventions on GBVF, and also particularly in matters that relate to men, reaching out to men and the cases that they will receive. So there's a reference system between CGE and our department. And as I've said, that we have the under the tree men's program, which is for men and boys, and CGE is part of it. Last week we also had one that was in Cape Town, in Western Cape. We had the representation of one of the commissioners coming to that intervention. So we have it, we work very closely with CGE. Then now coming to the femicide watch, then the femicide watch, as I said, that we started, it's an intervention that we responded as a department to the special rapporteur for violence against women and violence against women, yes. So when she came into our country in 2015, so in the report that she gave the country was to say that we needed to develop the femicide watch. So the department took up that responsibility. So phase one, it was about developing then the prototype for femicide watch that will be guiding not only South Africa, but also other countries in Africa who are interested in developing this intervention. So phase two then was looking into developing now the dashboard. And this dashboard, then it looks into, it is developed on the IJS, that is the Integrated Justice System Transversal Hub, where you have all the departments then sharing the data. And currently, the data is focusing, the data that is being shared, it is on the reported matters. We are moving on then to capture also those cases where then the deaths have not been reported, because we have been informed, especially in rural communities, that there are those women who die and then they will be buried, you know, down in the garden and so on. So we want to capture those cases as well. So, but now we are starting with the reported cases of GBVF-related femicide cases. So then the dashboard then has got a number of areas then of collecting data, for the lack of a better word. So it talks about, it takes the, what is the weapon that has been used, where was this, where did this woman die, and how did she die, and then tracks then the case from the entry point from the entry point into the criminal justice system up to the exit, so that we have the history of the case, we are able to track and trace up to the end. So this is what we did then in phase three. Now phase four, which is in this financial year, we are looking now into the live data and analyzing that live data to ensure that then we are able to bring the very first data set for the country. But we will not be making it public first. We will be looking then into ensuring that all the stakeholders that are involved in this process are able then to collectively analyze the data. That will be taking us to phase five then to make it open to the public. Thank you.
Thanks, Advocate Kambula. Just the two questions on the transgender and intersex dialogue. That is, it's been a long process, a program with the support of the European Union, involving departments of justice, home affairs and health, and civil society organizations working in the sector. It involved a trip in 2019 to Malta to look at what they are doing on the issues. And one of the requirements was a dialogue which could only take place this past month, because of we wanted a physical dialogue as far as possible because of COVID. The issues are obviously for transgender people, the issue of gender markers in the ID, and Home Affairs have actually made quite a lot of progress, and they're considering two options. Your number after your birth date is your gender marker. 0 to 4, I think, is women. 5 to 9 is men. They're looking at whether there should be a gender neutral marker, or whether to do away with the gender marker altogether. Then it's issues of the alteration of sex legislation, and the need to reform that, and to ensure that currently it requires a waiting period of 2 years before you can change your gender, and a number of medical reports. The rest of the world is basically moving towards self-identification. Intersex, the issue is primarily what's called infant genital mutilation, where a child is born with both two sets of sex organs, and the doctors take out the one that is less prominent, which may not be the gender that the child is actually, or the person is going to identify with. So there's a report coming out. There was a 2-day dialogue. There was then a third half-day meeting, a smaller meeting between government and civil society to chart the way forward. And then the last question, what is really happening? Look, there's a lot of challenges. On the issue of gender-based violence and protection orders, it's been particularly difficult in the COVID period. We've tried to keep the courts all open for these, but things on the ground have often been different, with courts imposing quotas on people who can come into the court. The key issue there is where officials are not doing what they're meant to be doing. We need to find ways of reporting that, of taking that up. We had the situation right at the start of the lockdown of a woman coming to the Belleville court, leaving without getting the protection order, and then later being murdered. That matter we referred to the public protector because we thought it would be a more neutral investigation, and the finding was that nobody was specifically to blame for her not getting the protection order filled up. But my question is, well, she went there with the intention of getting a protection order and she didn't complete the form. Why was that? As far as the sexual offences courts, it would be issues of, again, delays caused by COVID, somebody being off sick, witnesses not being able to come, that kind of thing. It's issues of the equipment at sexual offences courts sometimes not functioning and not being repaired in time. And also the problem is, I'm seeing it particularly in KZN in the eThekwini area, the number of cases, sexual offences, rapes that are being reported at the police station are increasing. The number of cases going to trial are decreasing. So we're meant to have 2 sexual offences courts in Umlazi and 2 in Ntuzuma. We've only got 1 each operating at the moment because there isn't the volume to justify 2. So there's a whole lot of issues. Yes, the department does tend to produce the glowing picture, but there's a whole lot of practical issues and problems on the ground. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you very much, Honorable DM. I do have a question that I wish we should park and probably ask once the Department of Women has presented. In slide 26, Advocate Kambula, you did note the fact that there is a draft national prevention strategy against femicide that has been finalized. And one wants to know how then this links up with the current draft national prevention strategy that is being developed by the Department of Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities. I think we need to answer that once the Department of Women has presented at a later stage. But maybe Comrade DM, one would like to check the issue of the challenges on legal aid, given the fact that women do need a legal assistance. And there is a challenge of the cost currently to procure the private lawyers for cases of GBV. Maybe we could get an answer to that one question.
Yeah, Chair, look, with protection orders, the system is meant to be that legal representation is not needed. People can have legal representation if they want. Legal aid will often step in if the other side is represented. What happens is there's a two-stage approach. You get an interim order first, where the respondent is not even notified that you're getting the order. The idea is to quickly give you the order so you've got protection. Then the matter is set down for another date where the respondent has got the chance to come and put his version. That's where it may sometimes be necessary for legal representation, and legal aid do try and step in. But if nobody has a lawyer, actually the magistrate can run the process on their own. It's an inquisitorial process, not an accusatorial like where you need lawyers. As far as the sexual offences cases and the criminal cases, look, the lawyer of the complainant is the prosecutor. There's no space in our system for a separate lawyer. They can't speak in court. If they're there, they would just have a watching brief. But I think it's something that we need also to engage more on. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable DM. Honorable members, let us then move swiftly to the next presentation from the Department of Police. I will hand over to the Honorable Minister to introduce his team and then hand over to the officials who will be doing the presentation. Over to you, Honorable Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. Chairperson, the preparations for this presentation in the absence of the minister who was with the president in Nigeria, then the deputy minister was responsible for preparation for this presentation. So I will hand over to the deputy minister, Matale, to take us through. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Chair. And good morning to members of the committee. It's always an honor and a privilege for us to appear before the committee so that we can explain ourselves, but also through our interactions with you, we always get enriched. We become better than before we came to appear before you, because from where you are, you have unique eyes and ears to see and understand things better than we sometimes do when we are in the mix of things. We really appreciate this platform, and thanks, Minister, for allowing us to proceed with the presentation. We have a delegation with us, chaired, led by the Deputy National Commissioner, Detectives Lieutenant General Nzinga, together with the Divisional Head, Lieutenant General Mtala, and other operatives that are there are a part of our delegation. If you can allow, Chair, I'll request that General Nzinga, because I have not introduced everybody who is with us, she introduces our team and lead with the presentation and allow the person responsible to lead with the presentation. If you may allow, Chair, I'll ask that we allow Lieutenant General Nzinga to introduce the team and lead in the presentations. Through you, Chair. General Nzinga.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, and honorable members, Minister of Police, the DM, and also senior management of the police. Let me also first appreciate the opportunity afforded to us to present the progress made in the implementation of the NSP for the period June 2021 to October 2021. Just to introduce my team, it's myself. I've got General Mutlala, General Nsia, General Rich, Major General Mokhale, Major General Matonsi, Major General Lushaba, Brigadier Michel, and Brigadier Sheila Malakhela, and also Colonel K.B. Stein. The presenter from our side will be Major General Matonsi, who is leading the program of the NSP. With your permission, DM, can I hand over to General Matonsi to take us through with the presentation?
Yeah, please, General Matonsi.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, for the opportunity. Our Minister, General Cele, Deputy Ministers, the members of the Portfolio Committee, senior officers, all protocols observed. I'm going to take the committee through a brief overview of the progress from SAPS perspective. I'll cover the overview and then the conceptual framework just to indicate the link to the NSP, which also Advocate Kambula also touched on. And then I will then go through the progress on specific areas that we want to highlight, and then some data on the evidence collection kit. The overview first is to say that as South African Police Service, our main focus is pillar three. Of course, as part of our response to GBV, we do address other pillars, but in the main, we are addressing pillar three of the NSP. The SAPS mandate, as we know, it emanates from the Constitution 2053, which is about preventing, combating, and investigating crime, maintaining the public order, protect and secure the inhabitants of the Republic and their property, and to uphold and enforce the law. And the reason why this is important is that our involvement into the whole issue of GBV also has to respond to the our constitutional mandate, which is coming from the Constitution. So we're just going to give a progress overview from that period. I must also indicate that we are reporting to the presidency on monthly basis on the progress that we are making on the GBV issues. Let's move to the next one. If we move to the next one, this one is just to indicate that everything that we are doing, it talks to the NSP that all the departments are talking to. NSP, as we know, that there are different role players, different agencies or government departments that are playing their role. We're also playing our role as well. But more importantly, that I want to stress on this one is that as SAPS, after the NSP was approved, we decided that we're going to have our own national GBV action plan. And the reason for that was to make sure that we can identify critical areas that we want to focus on that addresses the priorities emanating from the NSP. So we do have that national plan, but over and above, we also established a national steering committee for the GBVF so that there is proper direction and leadership at a higher level. And we then also established the provincial steering committees who also must work with different stakeholders, including the civil society and other non-governmental organizations at a local level, so that we are able to integrate our efforts going forward. So that plan is assisting us to focus on critical things that we need to do, which are the things that we're now going to go through them one by one. First one is the issue of resourcing of the infrastructure. I'm not going to read line by line. I'm just going to explain the context of what it means. The first one around the infrastructure is mainly about expanding our capacity at the Eastern Cape as well as KZN Forensic Service Laboratory. And the reason for that, as we know, that we are coming from a period where we had some challenges with the backlog on the DNA. So we are trying continually to expand our resources so they were able to process the DNA as quickly as possible. But also we had to do a study on that one. And the reason for that is that, like other departments as well, we are constrained in terms of prioritizing the focus in terms of our budget. So that process is finalized in terms of the investigation, and we are going to have to expand our capacity in those two provinces, which will assist us to respond to some of the challenges of DNA analysis. Number two was around the issue of the capacity. We also look at what are the resources that we need that will form part of, this is human resources, that will form part of the what we call FCS, which is a specialized unit that focuses on these cases of GBV and as well as the children. We did that. We know exactly what are our requirements, but obviously we also have to balance our requirements with the resources that we have. We, as I said, we are not different from other departments in terms of the budget cuts. So we also have to weigh those scales and see how we can balance that. If we move to the next one, which then I want to talk in terms of those years. In 2019-20, we allocated, my apologies, we didn't mention the number there, but we allocated 312 posts for the FCS unit, which is our specialized investigation unit, but we only managed to place 298 members. That was 2019-20. Last year, we did not allocate additional posts. 2021, we have to look at the additional allocation now. And the reason we have, or the challenge that we have, as we know, is that we haven't been able to train members due to the COVID restrictions. So we've lost 2 years of training members, and therefore that has also delayed our capacitation of the FCS. As we know that the 298 members that we allocated to the FCS unit was for the entire country. So the number might look big, but it was actually not a big number. It's not enough. So that's what we're planning to do going forward, to allocate additional members who can support the FCS. When we look at the numbers in terms of reducing the cases, violence against women and children, these are the numbers in terms of 2021-22. This is our, here we're trying to monitor on a constant basis as to whether are we resolving all the cases that come in. If we look at 21-22, for instance, on crimes against women and children, we had 8,097 cases, and we finalized 7,455, which means that we managed to resolve 92% of the cases that we received. Sorry, we said the reduction should be resolved. We resolved 92%. When we look at the children, we had 3,872 cases, and we finalized 3,494, which is also 90% resolution or solvency rate, if I can call it that way. So that's how we are monitoring those cases. If we move to the next slide. If we look at the processing of the forensic case exhibits, which we are monitoring all the exhibits as they come into the system or into our forensic environment, they get captured and recorded. So these numbers are indicating those numbers that we have received. 5,823 registered between September and that. We broke down in terms of the period as we report to the presidency on monthly basis. And then from 24 to the 21st of June, we had 1,945 cases that were completed. And then we also had the previous backlog where we processed during that particular period, just above 14,000 cases that were finalized. Sometimes the challenges that we will have is that the non-availability of the consumables, the equipment that we need. And also, we've also had serious challenges in terms of our buildings closing. We close from time to time. I think as of now, we probably have 3 or 4 buildings that are closed for contamination. So that has also affected our processing of the exhibits from our forensic environment. Then the next one is focusing on the FCS unit members. Because our members, they deal with these sensitive cases, which also affect them. We also prioritize their debriefing as well for trauma. So during the period that we are reporting on, we did 507 FCS members for trauma briefing. Let's move to the next one. And then if we look at the effective management of complaints, again, this is one of the issues that we are prioritizing. But we started by amending the national instruction that had been done in 2017, as well as the standard operating procedure. And the reason for that is that we want to streamline the processing of the complaints, but we're also allocating times in terms of how quickly the complaint should be resolved. So we're therefore monitoring as to how quickly the complaints that we receive are processed and finalized. If we look at the term from June, July, we had 30 complaints that were received, and 100% of them were resolved within 7 days. So just maybe to explain how the process works is that when a person is launching a complaint, we will then investigate the complaint, interview the person, get all the information. But once the complaint has been resolved, our members will also go to the person who lodged that complaint and make sure that it is explained to that person, and also he signs a particular form to confirm that he's been given a feedback. So that is what applies in all the complaints that we have. So that's just the breakdown of the numbers. If we look at the next term from July to August, we had 42. They were also finalized within 7 days, as well as the next period, also 58 complaints received. This is across the country. These are only complaints relating to the GBVF only, which we are monitoring to make sure that they are processed on time. So I think that's just, I want to stress that here, that we are trying to finalize each and every complaint within 7 days. And we have a dedicated environment inspectorate. There's a particular section that deals with service complaints throughout the country. And also we have resources across all provinces. We can move to the next one. We look at the next one. It talks about victim-friendly service. When it comes to victim-friendly service, there are two things that we look at in the main. We're looking at the victim-friendly facilities, the room or the building where we can be able to interview a complainant. And second, we look at the training. For training, we look at specific training for our members. We look at the victim empowerment, domestic violence, sexual offenses. We look at those in the main. So when we talk about victim-friendly service, so we are combining those elements for the purpose of our measurement and reporting, and that's how the AG assess us in terms of this. So we are 100% in terms of this. But what this means is that our stations, they have the victim-friendly rooms. Those that they don't have, they will have alternative facilities where they are able to accommodate the victims when they come to the station. Then if we look at the next one, talking to the top 30 stations or top 30 areas, there were 30 areas that were identified because of the prevalence and the high numbers of GBV in those particular areas. So we encourage those stations to go out and conduct outreach programs. So in the reporting period, we had 68 awareness programs that were conducted in those top 30 GBV hotspot areas between August and September, and another 104 programs that were conducted between September and October. So these are constant programs that they do. And the reason for that is we want to encourage communities to come forward and report crime. That is mainly what it is. But secondly, also to pick up if there are any complaints and dissatisfaction data from the community. That is the purpose of going out and having those outreach. And this excludes the outreach programs that the Office of the Minister also conducts. These are one that are focused specifically in those top 30 areas. The challenge with this, and which I also want to raise for the community, maybe not a challenge, but what tends to happen is that the more we raise awareness, the more we'll get people will come out and want to report cases which may be 20 years old and so on and so on. So sometimes when the cases reported increases, is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a reflection that we are working, not just us, but also other organizations, to sensitize the community to report. So we may find that the numbers are shooting up. It's because we are encouraging people to report those cases, even if they're old. Then the next one, it talks to the vetting process, as we are required to vet. These are we had 518 certificates that were issued during that period, and we continue to do that. This one is addressing the protection of children as well as the mentally ill persons in terms of the National Register for Sex Offenders. We can move to the next one. The next one talks to training. There is a proactive training where we take an initiative to go out and train members to address specific areas. Then there is also reactive training where we are doing training to respond to a particular challenge that we picked up. So these are the numbers of training for that period. In June to July, we had 170 members that were trained and also declared competent, because it's not just about participating in the course, but also we test and make sure that out of the number that is participating, whether did they actually become competent or understood what they were being trained on. And then from July to August, we had 217 members and 215 were declared competent. Those members who are not declared competent, they will be given a chance either to like a supplementary, if I can use that university language, or if not, they will join the other course in the future to make sure that they can catch up with the knowledge that that is parted by our training department. So those are the numbers that just indicate training. And we are raising this because it's also one of the things that will help us to respond better, that we constantly providing training to members. But also I must indicate that these numbers does not mean that these are only members that are trained, because members are trained during their basic training as well in terms of those programs that I mentioned, sexual offenses, victim empowerment, and domestic violence. So that is proactive. In terms of the reactive training, we had 414 members trained and 395 were declared competent. which is 95.4%. Then the next one talks to the availability of liquor, and liquor is important when we deal with the GBV because it is a contributor as well in terms of most of the gender-based violence and other crimes, actually. If we look at June to July, we had 607 illegal liquor premises that were closed, terminated. And then in August to September, we had 1,191 illegal liquor premises that were closed. And then in September to October, we had 1,270. I must indicate on this one, Chair, that this one is also one of those difficult areas because as you close them, they reopen. In other words, if you close that 1,200 between September and October, it might happen that 800, they're also back operating as we are speaking. So this one is kind of a moving target for us, that we constantly conduct operations on these areas, but they will always reopen and reopen and reopen, but we'll continue to monitor going forward. If we can go to the next slide. The next slide talks to the gender-based violence desk. I think this is the last focus area that I want to talk to. The gender-based desk, as a result of a number of complaints that we get from the victims, others were even in the media, everyone saw them. The decision from the department was that we'll establish gender-based violence desk so that they are specialized area and specialized individual that can focus on victims who will have a proper understanding and also be prepared and trained to be able to deal with the victims of gender-based violence when they come to the station. We therefore decided that we will only implement it in phases. And the reason for that is that we must say upfront, Chair, that we are also very limited in terms of the resources. But also, it's a new initiative. We also wanted to see how is it going to work going forward. So we decided then that phase one will do all the top 30 stations plus Western Cape. So what we have now finalized, those 134 desks are now done, which is Western Cape 121, KwaZulu-Natal 7, Eastern Cape 3, Free State 1 station, Northwest 1, Gauteng 1. So the phase one was finished at the end of September. Where we see 1 or 7 in KZN is because those are their priority stations, which are part of the top 30. Then phase two will then focus on 30 stations per each province, which then we're targeting to finalize that by the end of the current month. And then the remainder of the station then will be rolled out by the end of the current financial year, which is the 31st of March. And we believe that as we started just mid-year to roll out this process, that we're still going to review and see how they are functioning. But we are confident that once they start operating and they are fully prepared and capacitated, that we'll be able to respond properly to the complaints that we have received, but also we'll be able to provide better care to the victims when they come to the station so that we don't expose them to secondary victimization as has been alleged in the previous incidents. I think that's the last focus area. And then the next is just the numbers. If we can go to the next one, the next slide. It was just to indicate the breakdown of the numbers. I think here, without going through each and every number, there are critical kits or set of kits that is required. First one being D1, which talks to a collection kit for the sexual offenses, talking to adults, and then D7 for pediatric sexual assault collection kit. If we look at the numbers of the kit that we ordered, I think it's fair to say that we are getting all the numbers that we have requested, and we are hopeful that the issue of running out of the kit will not be an issue. But the other thing that I would like to maybe to also highlight to the chair, to the members of the community, is that we make sure that each and every FCS unit, because FCS unit, they specialize on these cases, sexual offenses cases. So they always have the collection kit. So it might happen that at the time at the station, they might be short of the kit, but the people who actually deal and handle these cases will always have the kit in their offices or in the boot of their car when they attend to a complaint of any sexual offense cases. So this is just the distribution without going through all the numbers. If we go to the next slide, it also shows the different numbers. And this is an ongoing process. It might happen that one or two, if we look at D7, for instance, where we ordered 29,896, 23,094 were delivered, which means that there's still some stock that is outstanding. But what I only want to stress is that the process is on. The procurement, it's sorted. All the issues are sorted. The kit is delivered as required. I think that is the last one. I think if we can move to the last one. Yes, I think the last slide is just summarizing that. We can move to the last one, to the next one. Oh, sorry. I think just in conclusion, Chair, is just to say that our critical challenge, as Chair raised that, or a member of the committee raised the issue, that is around the issue of training. We have lost 2 years of training, and therefore it limits our ability to capacitate FCS, which is our specialized unit that deals with these cases. Then the second one, obviously, is the budget cuts, which applies to every department. The budget cuts obviously will affect us in terms of ensuring that all the stations that don't have the victim-friendly rooms are equipped. Because what we have done, we have developed a sort of a long-term plan for those stations that still need the facilities. But those facilities obviously will require funding for those buildings to be put in place. And then obviously the big one is the issue of the human resources as well as their training. I think on that note, I think that covers our report. I submit, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister.
Oh, no, I was saying thanks very much, Chair. That was the end of our slide presentation. And thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Chair. We're still here.
Thank you very much, DM. Thank you, Minister. Okay, thank you, Minister. Let us appreciate, honorable members, the presentation that we have just received from the Department of Police. I will then hand over to honorable members who wish to make comments or are having questions of clarity. I can see the hand of honorable member Yako, honorable member Vilma, honorable member Sharif, honorable member Telebranch, honorable member Mpiti, honorable member Shembeni, honorable member Maseko Jele, honorable member Kiri. In that order, honorable members, starting with honorable member Yako.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Unfortunately, I cannot put on my video right now, if I may proceed. Thank you very much for the presentation. When I looked at it, I just had a couple of questions. When the presenter says that some cases have been resolved, I would love to know what constitutes a resolved case with regards to a gender-based violence case. And also, with regards to the gender-based violence desks that they've put, I see there's three, for instance, in the Eastern Cape. Could they list for us exactly where those gender-based violence desks are in which police stations? And also maybe indicate how often do they look into those gender-based violence desks as to how functional they are? So that we can see if not just putting a desk, but how is it effective in assisting those who have cases such as rape cases and any kind of gender-based violence case? Is it efficient, or is it just maybe to just rubber stamp, a footpath? Thank you.
Thank you, Member Yako. Honorable Member Vilma.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And good morning to everybody on the platform. Thank you very much for the presentations. I have a few questions, and thank you for the opportunity that I may ask them. Could the host please spotlight Honorable New Hope Drusen and not show the interpreter?
Nelisa, can you assist us with spotlighting Honorable Member Zuma?
All good.
Great. Thank you. So thank you, Chair, and good morning to everybody on the platform, and thank you for the presentation. In the presentation, with regards to awareness raising, I see that the awareness raising done given by SAPS to schools. I know it's been a difficult year with the COVID virus, and schools have been opening and closing, and you know the system has changed in terms of them attending school all the time. So I would like to find out the number of presentations or awareness raising that SAPS provided to children. I firmly believe that early education for children will assist them in learning about early reporting. So I'd just like to find out about the figures for the awareness raising. I am happy that SAPS is working with DESA. That there is an agreement that the members, the SAPS members are learning South African Sign Language. And we really encourage that wherever possible, that the members learn South African Sign Language so that deaf people, when they need to report cases, there's an ease of communication and interpreters will not be necessary. I would like to raise a concern while everybody's here on the platform. I really wouldn't like to miss this opportunity. In my constituency work, I visited a SAPS police station and we got the information that an offender was released on parole. However, the victim and the community were not informed that offender was released. And obviously the first place anybody goes to complain is a police station. So we just like to find, so they reported that to the police station. And the police officers there said it is not their responsibility to inform the community when an offender is released. So I would like to find out, how is it coordinated? I mean, I know the offenders are the responsibility of correctional services, and it's a pity they are not on the platform. But how is it coordinated between the SAPS and the correctional services? How is it coordinated so that the community and the victims can be informed when an offender is released? I mean, it's, yes, okay, the SAPS can say it's out of their hands, but surely there should be some kind of formal system for this to happen. And then in the second constituency visit, there was a language issue that came up. So my constituency is a very rural Afrikaans-speaking community. And so when a female victim goes to the police station, she speaks Afrikaans. But then the SAPS member says it has to be written in English. The statement has to be written in English for the court purposes. So the SAPS member wrote the statement in English and read it out in English, but then the victim was not able to, you know, confirm nor deny what was written, because that's not her language. And that's like a secondary traumatizing in terms of language. So is the victim allowed to express themselves in the language that they are most comfortable in? I mean, I believe that would be important, that that should be the case. And that is all from me for now. Thank you very much, Chair.
Much appreciated, Honourable Member Vilma. The next member to ask a question or comment is Honourable Member Kel Branch.
Yeah. I have a few questions, but let me start by appreciating the presentation that we've got. I think it was very informative. Chairperson, I just want to know, it was indicated by the police presenter that they are in the process of, you know, building capacity, if I can call it that, in the Eastern Cape and also KwaZulu-Natal. And I was just wondering whether we have maybe a completion date of the facilities that they have in mind, firstly, and secondly, what exactly it entails. That is my first question. Chairperson, then, if we go on to slide 6, it was also mentioned that quite often or a few times the buildings got closed. And I can just imagine that that is due to COVID-19 problems that they experienced there. My question on that is, we have discussed it in the police portfolio quite a few times, and my question is whether a shift system has been introduced, and if not, what is the progress on that? Chairperson, then on slide 8, we were told that 1,155 police stations, 100% of them have victim-friendly service centers, but then immediately, and you know, if I understood that, you know, not correctly, I just want to be informed about that, that where such facility is not available, they have other facilities. Do they comply with the basic standards? And if not, what is the problem that it can't be patients, the proper, you know, functioning facility? Chairperson, and then also the you know, we have 1,000 trained people. You know, it's quite obvious that we don't even have a trained member per police station yet. And I just want to get clarity on that. And what is being done that we are going to have, you know, a trained person, you know, at every police station, and even taking into account that they are working on a shift basis. So obviously, quite often, they are going to have, you know, a shift operating without a proper trained person. Chairperson, and then it
we can't hear Honorable.
Chairperson, we can't hear the Honorable Blanche.
About me now, Chairperson.
Honorable Chairperson, we have a problem with your network. You are not audible.
If he can switch off his camera, it might help.
Yes, I think maybe.
Can you hear me now, Chairperson?
Yes, we can clearly hear you now. You may go ahead.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was busy with my last question. I hope you've been able to hear the previous questions and the last question. It was mentioned equipping or converting this budget or this victim-friendly centers. But I think the police will agree with me that there was a huge under expenditure, you know, in the capital budget, you know, the capital budget as such. So there was no a shortage of funding. And I just want to get clarity on that as well. Chairperson, thank you. That was my last question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. The next member is Honourable Sharif.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start off with red kits. Minister Kwele, you told us in Parliament that every single police station has stock of rape kits. However, this weekend, a victim was raped in Johannesburg. She went to Roodepoort SAPS, no rape kit. She went to Krugersdorp SAPS, no rape kit. She then went to Florida SAPS, and again, no rape kits. She only managed to get the rape kit when she went to a Netcare hospital in order, you know, to get the evidence. And so the fact that that a victim had to go to three different police stations in her sense of trauma is unacceptable to find rape kits. So perhaps it needs to be re-looked at how these rape kits are ordered and how they are distributed. If only FCS units have rape kits, this is obviously not working because it's not trickling down to police stations. So that's the first issue. The second issue I have, Chairperson, is that if you go to slide number 5, it shows a comparison that sexual offences, the stats is at 39.7% for sexual offences. Rape is at 40.4% during quarter one. But why don't we get the information for quarter two that shows a upward trend? So in quarter two, you have sexual offences 74%, rape at 73.4%, sexual assault by 77.2%. So there's obviously a trend that happens. And we all know, especially those that do oversight to police stations and to Tudela care centres, that when festive season comes around, the amount of incidences that happen increase by a lot. And it seems as if, you know, there needs to be more intervention happening during these times. And so I just wanted to find out why the department or why SAPS is only presenting for one quarter when we, in fact, as a committee, need to look at it holistically so that we can see how it fluctuates and we can see if interventions are working or not. Second issue is underspending invisible policing and detective services. This has a direct impact on FCS units and dealing with GBVF, especially looking at the number percentage in the number of contact crimes against women and children. So I would like some information on why there was underspending and what is the interventions to ensure that departments are spending their money or units are spending their money to increase the fight against GBVF. I mean, if you are underspending for FCS units and detective services, this deals directly with GBVF cases, so there's obviously a problem there. I'm not happy with the false sense of progress that is given to us here in this committee, and I would like for the department to go back and rethink how they report it. And again, just like the Department of Justice, we are not here to hear your shining, you know, interventions and oh, it's amazing, butterflies, fairies. No, we're here to hear what's really happening on the ground, what's really the issues, and how do we solve them? How do we pick up what's going wrong, and how do we come up with new smart ideas to make sure that it doesn't continue happening? Also, the underspending under forensic science lab sub-program, this is an issue. Issues around capacity and FCS units and the underspending of compensation of employees. I imagine this goes with the point you made around COVID and how COVID was a challenge, a stumbling block for that. And I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I cannot accept COVID as an excuse in 2021. We've lived with COVID for quite some time. Other organizations, departments have, you know, found ways to deal with the COVID, with COVID and the issues that come with it. And SAPS need to do the same. You can't come here to this committee and say, oh, because of COVID, we couldn't train people. We have Zoom. We have Microsoft Teams. We have so many mechanisms that we can use, that this is just not acceptable anymore. Okay, so they have asked that the underspending on capacity of FCS units, victim-friendly services. I went to two police stations last week, and I think it's just right for me to say well done to Moroka Police Station in Soweto and Hillbrow Police Station. Their victim empowerment rooms is excellent. They are warm, they are colorful, they have good, you know, good lighting. They don't feel like you're in a cell or in a dark place that can contribute to second degree trauma. However, we did find that there's a lack of social workers at these VEP rooms. And so what is the SAPS intervention to ensure that collaboration with social development increases so that the amount of social workers increase at these police stations? It doesn't help having one social worker dealing with thousands of cases. It's just overburdening. And social workers are also human beings, and they can't always deal with everything that's happening. How do you measure if a VEP room is adequate? So what is your measuring tool to ensure that VEP rooms are adequate since you reported on them? And how do you monitor and ensure training is happening at these police stations? On my oversight visits, a lot of the police stations say that they have their own internal training that they do, for GBVF, and I think that's a really good idea. But how do you monitor it as the department? How do you monitor that this training is happening and that the training is good? That the training is good and that it's not just looking at the you know face value, but actually going deep into patriarchal norms, social norms and standards, and how we fight GBVF from that perspective. Next, you spoke about vetting service providers and given 518 certificates. When are these certificates renewed on an annual basis? Are these certificates re-looked at? Because I can get a certificate tomorrow, I can do a crime, and then I still am competent. So how do you look at the renewal of these certificates? Again, on the training, you said SAPS to be declared competent. What does competency mean in this instance? And then your evidence kits, you say you ordered all of these evidence kits. Where do you order them from? And how long do they usually take to get here? And what is your intervention looking at Roodepoort, Krugersdorp and Florida police stations that currently don't have any rape kits? Something needs to be done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Member Sharif. The next member to make contributions and or ask questions is Member Mpiti.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and a very good morning to all colleagues on the Zoom. Honorable Chair, I would just really like to begin. I'm very glad that my colleagues, Honorable Yako and Honorable Sharif, have covered me on the issue on slide 5, because I really find it extremely problematic for us to only just report quarter one and not be given a full picture. And I think, as Honorable Yakwe has said, the referral that these cases have been finalized is something that really needs to be expanded upon. Were they closed? Were those cases closed? Or were they successful in terms of arrest? I think we just really need to have some clarity on that particular issue. My next question relates to the update on whether there has been any updates in terms of convicted rapists, sexual offenders who have been released from prison, and whether their DNA samples have been taken. We know that there's been reports that a lot of sexual offenders are released without their DNA samples being taken. What is being done about that? What are the mitigating strategies that are being put in place to ensure that people who have committed sexual offenses can be tracked and are easily tracked should they recommit sexual offenses? Yes, I also have a question around the rape kits as well. We know that from the oversights that we've done, some Thuthuzela care centers wait for the police to bring rape kits to the Thuthuzela centers. And they only do this when the Thuthuzela care center calls on the police to say that there is a victim that requires that. What is the official position of SAPS in this regard? Is it that red kits stay at the Thuthuzela care centers, or is it that police officers are required to deliver red kits to the Thuthuzela care centers when there is a victim that comes through after an incident like that? Can I just have some clarity on that issue? And then also just in regards to case identification regarding assault, do we know or do we separate cases that relate to assault from cases that relate to gender-based violence? Or are they all grouped together? So if an assault happens, whether it be, you know, a physical assault, someone getting robbed or someone being assaulted over a fight, versus an assault that happens through intimate partner violence, is there a difference that is being made with these numbers, or are they grouped together? And I'd just really like to understand if that is the case. Also, just in relation to the IPED report that speaks to, you know, the increase in police officers who are being charged with rape, what exactly is being done? What are the interventions that are being done where more and more police officers who are entrusted to protect South African citizens, to protect the most vulnerable people in the society, are now being found to be committing these egregious acts in society, are found to be raping. So what is being done with that increase amongst police officers who are found to be charged with rape? But further than that, there's also an issue around police officers being found to use their firearms off duty to use against, you know, their partners, to use against being involved in gender-based violence-related incidences. And so when you look at this entire picture, you find that, you know, more and more police officers are being found to be contributors to the scourge of gender-based violence that we have in our country. And I really believe it requires urgent an urgent look, where we need to understand exactly what is happening around those particular issues. I'd also would like an update on the DNA backlog. We know that there's been over 200,000 backlog in terms of DNA tests. How far are we in terms of making inroads on that backlog? What is being done to ensure that victims are able to get justice, you know, in a quick time? Because, I mean, you know, when you visit Thuthuzela care centers and you visit police stations, you hear about how people have to wait 3 months, 4 months, 6 months to get, you know, those DNA results coming back. So what is actually being done around that particular issue to help us fight the scourge of gender-based violence? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Member Mpitsi. Member Shembeni.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thanks for the presentation from the South African Police Services. Honorable Minister, Deputy Minister, South African Police Delegation, and all protocol observer. Yeah, I want to talk to firstly the issue of the FCS posts. I've noticed that you said there were 312 posts, of which 298 were filled. What happened to the 14? And where are these posts? Is it provincial, is it national, is it station level, or what? What is happening? Can we find out there what is happening? And what type of posts are these? Because we might say that they are posts, whereas we're talking about commanders. We're not talking about investigators. So I think we need a clarity there. And then secondly, my member from the DA has partially covered me here on the training due to COVID-19. I think something must be wrong there. It's unacceptable. How long does it take for an FCS training? Because it's not a training, actually, it's courses, which maybe sometimes take 3 months, but I want to know how long does it take for an FCS course to be completed? Thirdly, 507 members were sent for trauma briefing. Out of how many members that you have that need to be sent for trauma briefing? How many members does FCS have? And then coming to the LIQA premises that are being closed, I've seen there is a number of LIQA premises that are closed, but that is national report. Can we have the provincial breakdowns and the stations so that we know exactly that in Mpumalanga we have so many premises that were closed and then they were reopened? How? What measures have been taken to see to it that when they close, they cannot reopen? Are there any hefty fines for the repeat offenders? Because according to my understanding, they do it illegally. When you close, they open, you write a fine maybe of 1,500, of which it's nothing. They make that money per night. So what are the hefty measures that have been taken to stop the illegal trade of LIQA? I want to come to the issue of FCS members. I've noticed in some areas where there is an FCS unit which investigates dockets in 6 stations or 7, meaning there might be stations that are investigating more. What is it that is expected from such a group of members of 10 in that unit that is investigating dockets from 7 stations? How many dockets must each and every FCS member have, roughly, to be able to be effective? How many dockets must one investigator have? And then with the issue of the paroles, I think that the South African police there have got nothing to do with it because it is done by the correctional services and their boards, of which when it comes to the South African police, it's a difficult work and it's too much for the police. That they've arrested the person, brought to book, to court, and it has taken a lot of resources to get that person sentenced. At the end of the day, that person is given parole, and then when that person is out, the person rapes again within a week on parole, and then the police must leave everything and start again chasing on that particular person who was once arrested and kept in prison, but released on some other circumstances, which I don't understand whether it's the issue of rights or what, but I think a rapist is a rapist, that's what I can say. And there is no parole there to really, really talk the facts. Parole for what? Even if there is parole, okay, let those victims be contacted.
let these victims be the ones that they say that person can be given parole or whatever. Because in some other instances, there are these false rapes, which maybe people, they tend to be remorseful and go and say, yeah, they can release this person, knowing exactly that they weren't right. But that is the investigation of the South African police. So I wanted to know that what measures are there for the repeat offenders of these illegal outlets? How long is the FCS course? I think that is that, Honorable Chair, and the posts that were there, only 312. I mean, yes, and 298 that were filled. And then, as we talk about the gender-based violence and femicide, the President even spoke about this. I think we had to strengthen the FCS unit, but I think it's for the third year now, we've done nothing. Absolutely, SAPS has done nothing to change the attitude of the unit. I asked the minister, why are we losing members from this unit to this court? I did not get the correct answer, because I remember the minister spoke about threats, spoke about dockets. And then if people are carrying more than 50 or 100 dockets, they will be stressed, yes. So what are we doing for the members to carry less than that number? As I said, we would like to know that what is the number or what each and every investigator is supposed to have in terms of carrying the dockets. And then what is the SAPS going to do? Because COVID-19, it's not a reason for not training the members, because what is the period of these courses that these members are doing? I think for now, Chairperson, I'll close it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mbeni. Honorable Member Maseko Jele.
Thank you very much, Kristen. Today, members, and our department, and the minister, and the team, deputy ministers. Chairperson, I have only two or three questions that I just want to ask this one. The first one is just a general something that the minister that we have to report to the minister that out there, there is a general feeling or saying that there is a blame game, so to say, between the police and the courts when it comes to GBV cases on the issues of poor investigation by the police, and then also the readiness, issue of police readiness when presenting cases in the courts, particularly on those cases which are sometimes you find that the perpetrator is defensive and trying to argue the matter. You know, those that are straightforward where a perpetrator just agree, plead guilty. But those that want to defend themselves and bring their own issues, there is the women feel that there is a serious problem, even the families themselves, because they see that when they go to the courts, when their cases are reminded, or some of the cases being thrown out of the court because of a poor investigation by the police and some of the police not taking issues issues of gender-based serious. I just want to find out what is the department view on that and how can they, in fact, just to assist us in that area, report to us. Another issue is there has been reports about the offices, if I'm not mistaken, in Pretoria, serious problems that has been reported in terms of issues of forensic officers and the backlog on the DNA. I think my colleagues have mentioned that one. I just want to ask the department in terms of that issue, if it's still on their table, what have they done with that matter? And then the other one, Chairperson, is on training. I have a question because this is the issue where we have to get our answers when it comes to the quality of police that we deploy in different areas, particularly on this issue of GBV. I hear that, yes, training has been delayed, but we don't get to be informed of the plans going forward. I'm not sure if maybe I missed that one. If I can be briefed as to the plan in making sure that that area has been covered and addressed so that we can get those police deployed, especially on the issues of GBV, trained. Also on the very same issue of training, it is the issue of which police that we are talking about that has to be trained. Are we talking about all the police or only those that are assigned to GBV? Chairperson. Because I'm saying this, there is also an outcry of women when they go to police station, they still are subjected to the attitude of police, some not taking their cases serious, Chairperson. And lastly, it is the issue of recruitment. How is this recruitment done? I'll tell you why, Chairperson. Why I'm interested on this one. Because of the, we have been seeing these videos that are all over where you find the police, instead of protecting the community, they are running away. They are being, maybe it's running away too, I'm taking it far. But I want to say they are being hijacked by this group of hooligans who are intimidating them. They are even giving instruction and all that. I want to know when it comes to the recruitment, what kind of people that we are bringing to our police force? Chair, because I thought that maybe we need to get people who are ready, brave, who can stand and say, you know what, I'm doing my work. If you kill me, you kill me. If you do whatever, my work is to make sure that you are arrested and you are not doing this crime at this moment where I am. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member Maseko Chele. Honorable Kiri.
Thanks, Chair, and greetings to colleagues in the platform, as I observe protocol. Chair, you know, to be the last person, sometimes you become a bit redundant. But allow me, Chair, to have a bite on three issues, which I might be repeating what my colleagues have said, but I think we need to reiterate. One thing that I want to get clarity, as much as today we have the luxury of understanding the department itself, SAPS, and also appreciate their presentation. For me, it's very fruitful and giving me a bit of an understanding how they operate. But I want to understand their ratio of deployment of personnel. Whether do they just deploy in terms of per station, we are giving you so much personnel, or they also check the area. For example, I'm from a township that has got a port of entry where there's a lot of influx of illegal immigrants. So, you know, I've got interest in understanding how do you deploy from national, whether you check the area or it's just a normal standard or a ratio to deploy your personnel. But let me pass them. Secondly, Chair, on the issue of the illegal outlet, which is your Liqua, I really agree and concur with a colleague who just wanted to understand the consequence management. How are you dealing with those that you have closed down at the same time when they reopen, they don't meet the right standard or they don't have a licensing? Then what is the main disciplinary action? I'm not interested about the monetary value, but you know the consequence that comes with the person, him or herself. We must not talk about money, because you can make money illegally or legally. So as we are talking about an illegal outlet, but we need to be given, and you must put us in faith to say we are protected. At the same time, on the same issue, you know, we've got different types of our police officers. You have those that are saying, as the latter speaker have just said, to say, I'll fight, I'll make sure that I do my work. But you have those ones that, you know, they don't care as long as they are at work. At the same time, we are observing, we are community members. We know the outlet, I know for sure, they've just came and closed a particular outlet. Then during the day, the following day when they reopen, there's a police officer who's on CVs, it's private, it's not at work, and still drinking with the same people and buying from the same outlet. So I wanted to check with the generals who are here, who are responsible for their juniors, what are the programs or measures are there in the department to protect, and how do you really rate them to protect those you know you can see they've got interest at heart to protect South Africans at the same time, and those that they don't care, they are just there to work. You know, sometimes we use the same paint to paint everybody in the system, but they are not the same, Chair. But on that one, the main issue is that can they also have a plan to encourage and also to, you know, give that support to those who want to work? At the same time, what do you do with those that are there in the system, but they are risk, they're even risk for our citizens, poor citizens who need aid from them? Lastly, Chair, I've got a scenario, and you can relate to that. In our portfolio, while we're not in a joint, I've raised that, and it's happening. I think it's a matter of a policy, or be it an act, that is lacking. I'm not sure. I tried to make my research, but I'm not winning. Taking an advantage that in particular subs. Ntate Matali, in Musina, neighbor, in where I'm staying, my mother's house, you know, the next door neighbor, it's a renting area. And that stand, it's illegal immigrant. Let me put it that way, because there was a time when I was home and, you know, there was a gender
gender-based violence case, a woman who was due for delivery, 9 months pregnant, was beaten very heavily. And I was called by another neighbor to say they are fighting. When I got there, yes, we could find be it a partner or a husband, they were fighting. I managed to call a police station. When they arrived, you know, what was the response that is so unfortunate is that both of them, they don't have legal documents. There's nothing that we could do. But at the same time, you know, these things are happening in our country, in South Africa. Therefore, I don't know whether it must be upon all of us as South Africans, as members of the parliament, how do we deal with such cases? Because we are experiencing that on a daily basis as we are staying in a port of entry. There are a lot of them. And we can't shy away from that. But then how do we handle a case, even when a South African is having a relationship with an illegal immigrant and you have a case? It maybe we might not refer it to be a case because it's not yet opened and it cannot be opened on the basis that I was told or the person does not have a legal document. And that person's room is doing the same, committing the same crime, that he cannot be arrested. So I wanted to get clarity on that one to say, I don't even get it. And when people see us on the ground, they think we've got all the responses and we can assist them. And when you don't assist, it's a disappointment. Even to myself, it becomes a bit of a trauma. Chair, let me pause there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Piri. And thank you, Honorable Members, for your contributions, your comments, and your questions. I will hand over to the Honorable Minister, Deputy Minister, and the entire team from SAPS, whom we appreciate that we still have the presence of the Minister on the platform. But Minister, I think in the long run, it is quite important hearing the comments and the questions from the Honorable Members relating to the FCS units for us as the portfolio committees to really get the full report of the current status of the FCSs, especially as it relates to the issues of the numbers and the capacity on the ground. I will hand over to you, Minister, the DM, as well as the team, to respond to all the questions that have been asked by the honorable members.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, thanks to honorable members. DM will be there to take forward some questions, but the police will be answering specific questions. Some few answers as comments sometimes, Chairperson. I will urge members of parliament, and that includes even provincial legislatures and COP, when they see these things, when they do visiting, they don't wait for portfolio committees, but they pick up the phone and speak to the minister, whose number is even in the internet. My number is in the internet. You really, it's just a known number. The DM and the provincial commissioners and national commissioners of the matter, so that we act on these matters rather than make them the stories in the portfolio committee. Specifically, I want to talk about those police stations, three of them that did not have these kits. One should follow that, but it's always better to get that information while it's hot and work on those matters through the provincial commissioners, through the heads of the FCS in those provinces, and through the people that deal with the gender issues in those provinces. So I would urge that we immediately deal with that information so that we respond quickly on those issues. Secondly, I don't know about this thing, people's not taking COVID as an issue. I don't know why, as we're meeting now, we're meeting the ways that we have never met before.
I never been in parliament in this in the sitting room of my house, but I'm in parliament. And then for that change, we must understand that things have changed. I received the message this morning that in my own office of Ministry of Police, I've got two positive members in that office, which means nobody goes to that office, which means the programs that have been put there are disrupted. We can't get that, we can't get this. So I really don't know what it exactly means, because these figures we talk about will be the figures of 2021. And we all know what happened in 20, a March when the life was shut down, not just shut down, things that we have never experienced before of not going to the office. We have closed so many police stations. We have lost so many members. More than 800 members have died in the South African Police Service. Thousands of them have been hospitalized. Thousands have been hospitalized of these members. So college itself, somebody said recruits. Colleges that have not operated 2020 was supposed to train 7,000. We trained zero. 2021, we are training people, but mostly we're taking those that are shorter periods from the reservists rather than the standard training. So these are the issues that are there for members to say COVID can't be a reason. I don't know why it can't be. It has changed our lives. We were last week or last time as we are visual now. So it can change our life, but does not change the generic life as it would be for everybody else. And training must continue, but it will be on the minimum situation. Even if you train visually, right now, most colleagues will be in their offices, will be in their sitting rooms, will have a Wi-Fi and all that. So you wouldn't have Wi-Fi in some places at Engqoba, in some places at Mashonanga Shonet, Mahlabathini, and all this kind of thing. So the life has changed. I agree we must adapt, but it's a situation that has been thrown on us and we have never experienced before. So I will urge the members not to really downplay the situation, troubles and problems that have been unleashed to us by the COVID-19 as we go on with life. On the question of Honourable Member Shembeni really spoke on the parole. What I can add, we get frustrated ourselves about parole sometimes, and that we are not taken on board. A person that you thought is in prison already, you find that is your client, you need to chase that person. As such, maybe the bodies that deal with parole will have to be bodies that invite everybody, not just families, not just communities, but ourselves as police. We need to understand that somebody has been paroled. There is a person here we arrested in Pretoria, was very notorious. I think that person was given 105 years in 2012, and 105 years, but some people are talking about parole already of that person. Who almost 12 years out of 125 years. So those are the things that as the police, we really get frustrated and we have to chase those people that we have chased and we've done the work and we know that we have settled that one and we need to be doing new things. But all of a sudden you find those people on the streets again. The question of the shoddy work done by the police and the tit for tat between prosecution and the police. That should not happen. That should not happen, Honorable Members. I'm sure there are members of justice that are here. What is supposed to happen is that prosecution
and investigation must work together. Prosecution must be able to say to the police, this case cannot see, can't go through the court because these are the gaps. You go and fill those gaps. By the time we go to court and those things are tied up, that is happening, but not at the level that we would have loved to see it happen. And it's happening. That is why, colleagues, maybe the team, especially from the FCS, Matunt and them, will explain this. That is why we have more than 5,000 people who are doing life on the terms of the gender-based violence, doing life. For you to get life, it means if somebody did a good job in investigation and presenting the case, and for the magistrate and the judge to find it possible to give you life, it's because somebody has done the good job. So I would say those that they still have this tit for tat will have to work together to say that tit for tat must be in the preparation of the case rather than that happening in court. So I think we can round up on that one. The last point I'd like to make on this one, again on the FCS, it's not true that police haven't done anything. On the meantime, I think we have tried in year 19 and year 20, we have 20 new blood. There are about 312 people that we have added there, but we could not put those numbers as we wished because of the situation of training. For instance, as I'm saying, there's been no new blood that has been put in the police. And these specialized units will also recruit from the new blood, especially people like Honorable Member Shebeni will understand that there are units that they will only need the young people, your POP, your Special Task Force, your NIU, your GRT, even this unit will need the young people that have an extra maybe academic education, your social workers, which we are recruiting in the police, your lawyers and all that. So for the fact that we have not injected the new blood of which we are trying to work on it, it has stagnated the police, especially on this special unit. The last point I would like to make is on the question of the alcohol as one big generator of crime. I hope we'll be assisted here. For things to happen, it will be across the government departments. Just policing and policing agencies and security agencies alone, there are things that they can achieve. We now and again raise the issue of environmental design, colleagues. If you go to your places like your Khayelitsha, your Delf, Umakhaza, Marikana, that would be Western Cape, or you go to Zandspruit, you go to Diepsloot, you go to Inanda, there are places where you only see until the end of your hand because there are no lights in those places. Three weeks ago, I went to the Western Cape. It was very raining and it was dark where I went, where you go to this. There are these new mushroomed places in Western Cape called COVID-19. Called sanitizer. I visited COVID-19 and I visited sanitizer areas. There is nothing there. There are no roads. There is no electricity. There is no ablution. There is just nothing that tells you that human beings that are there can be policed or can work to expect police to drive across the township. There are no house numbers. There are no
cameras, just nothing, which are the things that can be helping policing. There are areas where the police need to leave their vans and walk because they can't drive through. There are those issues, environmental issues, that do not, those environmental issues, help the policing. That also take us to the alcohol problem. You know, members, we will have to be assisted here, especially as the police. I know when I was in KZN as an MSC for police and the other MSC for economic development, that's how you see it. These shippings, you see them as economic development, we see them as crime generators. Let me tell the story. We go to these communities, many of them, we do the profiling of the communities where we go there. So we are told how many churches, we are told how many schools, how many clinics, how many crèches, how many old home, and how many spazas. Almost all of these places we go, the biggest number are shippings, even those that are legal. For instance, if you go to Orange Farm, all these other amenities put together, your clinics, your schools, your spaza shop, are less than the shippings in Orange Farm. There are 331 shippings in Orange Farm, plus 17 bottle stores. And then, Honorable Shemben said, you close them, the next day you come back and they are there. It's because, Honorable Shemben and Honorable Members, we are not helped by prosecution on this one. And we are not helped by the individual provinces running their laws when it comes to alcohol. There is no overarching law. For instance, Gauteng has got 16 regulations and laws of alcohol. 16. They've got special permits of the weekend license, special permit of the party license. And as the police go there, because there is noise, and they come there, they are shown a special permit for them to make noise and drink until next day. If you go to Eastern Cape, there are special permits where you find one permit, one person having three permits. They have a permit of on-site sales, permit of off-site sale, and permit of distribution, which means people, they sit there, they drink. When you close, because you have an off-site sale, you sell them, you allow them to go with that. As they go with, you transport them because you have a license of distribution. So they are giving us headaches. When you go to Western Cape, they've got their special licenses. For instance, in Western Cape, if you have 150 liters, you are not regarded as the person that is selling. So if we confiscate that, you don't have a license to confiscate that, and the magistrate and the prosecution, they tell us to return your alcohol. Because what then they do, because you are not allowed to sell more than 150 liters, they sell 149 liters. So every time they stock 149 liters. So it's one major, major problematic area. And we are absolutely not assisted. We are told the next day by the magistrate, the prosecution, to give back the alcohol that we have confiscated, and those people the next day, afternoon, will be trading. And those areas are really areas where they are generating crime. So that's a situation sometimes as the police we face, and that we need other departments to work together across the government. So, Honorable Chair, I'll leave there and allow the Deputy Minister to lead the rest of the team to give the specific answers. I hope, especially the Nchinga, General Nchinga, will give us the update on the DNA issues, which I believe we have really turned the corner. I think we're on the fast lane. I think we're doing well to correct that situation. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Much appreciated, Honorable Minister. Honorable PM and your team, we just request for you to be a bit brief and not detailed on the responses. We still have a last presentation from the Department of Women, which we need to take. and we don't have much time to allocate that last presentation. So if we could just allow for you to respond briefly and not be too detailed with the responses.
No, thanks, Chair. I did realize that you are going to run into serious difficulties of time. I will just request General Ntinga to talk to the DNA and the other issues that were raised, which the minister did not talk to. Thank you very much, Chair. Through you, General Ntinga.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thanks, DM. I will go straight to those issues that are talking to DNA and forensic. There was a question of a capacity building on the labs, the specific dates. The Eastern Cape lab, there's a progress work there. They are already moving very fast to finalize. But according to the project estimate date, they said they will finish the whole job on February 2023. But I've seen them working. The construction is on site. KZN also, they are moving to a new building whereby TMS will be there in January to cable the whole building. So that means KZN will be able to move in at the end of January. Coming to the issue of the DNA backlog, Chair, I can say we have done a very good job in this area. We have moved very fast. As the minister said, we are now in the fast lane. Just to give you the numbers then, without wasting your time, there is a number there that is appearing in our slide. It says at that time we were at 88,662. Currently, we are at 76,976, of which we have done 11,686. On the actual backlog, the ring fence backlog, which was 180,191, we have moved to 80,548. That means we have done 99,643. So that means we are really moving very fast. The reason why we were having this backlog, we have also rectified that because all the contracts that were outstanding, that were expired, they are all in place. There's the only one that will be signing off tomorrow, the one of consumables. But the job is continuing. Also, in Cape Town, we are using a shift system of 6-2 and 2-10. At Pretoria, they are working flexi time. We are also paying overtime for the members to make sure that the job is done. Unfortunately, Chairperson, the COVID is here to stay. As I'm talking you to today in the Pretoria office, is closed. 80 members are gone for isolation. So that is also going to actually talk to our problem in terms of now working faster in the issue of backlog. So offices are being open and closed, but we are making sure that when our members are at work, we are pushing because the machines in Western Cape, all the lanes are working. So we are managing to do 2,000 a day. So on the issue of backlog, I can say that everything is fine. Even the time frame that was set for us for 18 months, we are going to beat it very much because we are really only, if you look at the numbers that are there now, we are at 980. So within 3 months, we'll be done with that one. The issue of rape case kids that are not in the station in Gauteng, we just find out that is not true. They do have the rape case, they've got enough. We find out from the provincial office, they check with the station, they do have a rape case. And then on the issue of the causes of FCS, the cause of FCS is taking 4 weeks to finalize. And also the norm of carrying a docket per investigator in the FS, we say is 40 dockets per member. But due to lack of shortage of personnel, they find themselves carrying more because we are losing members every day. And also on the issue of that case of the post of 312, the information is not readily available now, but we can make it available. We'll find out and then we can submit in writing on that one. On the issue of members who have gone the debriefing, 507. In total, FF, we've got 2,521 nationally. So that 507 is taken from that, of which I think we are still a bit behind. And also the investigators, also they are not availing themselves in time due to their lack their work, because they must always every day be in court, and they are also servicing many courts, not one court. Comes back to the members that are serving different stations. It is true. We have actually strategically placed the FS in the districts than before. For example, OR Tambo has got, I'm sure, about five. In the site of Lusiki, where you have the problem, we have decided to make Port St. John's a fully fledged unit, other than to have one in Lusiki. So we're working on that one. And also to fill up the post of the FCS, we are also going the route of doing lateral transfers and recruiting from other units. So it's not that we are not doing anything. We are doing our best to capacitate the FCS and also to train them. And also talking about the training, I think now the route that we want to take is to do the virtual training in those areas that they don't need practical studies, like we did with the cybercrime workshop. We did it virtually. That is where we get so many members who have been a workshop. So this is what we're going to look at going forward, because we see that COVID is not going away. We don't want to complain every day talking about COVID. We'll see whether we can also move all our most of our courses that don't need practical exercises to go on a virtual. So I will just leave the issues of the VSPOL, maybe General Mushlala and also General Ntia, through you, DM, can talk to issues of the members, the programs that are done by to the members. Thank you so much, DM.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant General. DM will request for the remaining questions to be sent in writing. If there's anything that is brief that DM and the generals can just give us so that we close it off. And then those that have been asked that need to be detailed will be sent in writing, Honorable DM, if we may agree in that manner, so that we're able to move to the next presentation.
Yeah, no, I think what we should do, Chair, so that we don't miss any point, we will request that that the Secretary of your committee give us all the questions that were raised, so that when we respond, we don't leave any question, because by mistake, as we're writing down, we might have omitted a specific question, and then we'll submit written questions to yourselves. But thank you for the opportunity you have given us. It's always a pleasure to interact with members of the Assembly. This is quite enriching and very helpful. Thank you very much, and we wish you well for the remainder of the day.
Much appreciated. To the Minister as well, we are greatly appreciating the presentations and the responses that you have given us. We will request and move in that direction, Honorable DM, that the Secretary will give the department the questions for written replies. We'll then, Honorable Members, swiftly move to the Department of Women, Youth and Persons with Disabilities, and we'll request the Acting DG to proceed, introduce the team, and then take us through the presentation. We will request the Acting DG that we are not detailed in terms of the slides, because we have received the presentation. You are just brief so that we can also allocate enough time for the questions as well as the answers from the Honourable Members.
So sorry, Chair, we forgot to ask to be recused. If you may allow us and the generals to leave, we'll appreciate that, Chair.
Granted, Honorable DM, you may be excused from the platform.
Thank you.
Most welcome. Acting DG.
Thank you and good morning, Chairperson, honorable members, deputy ministers or ministers and deputy ministers present and fellow colleagues. I am supported by two of my colleagues, and that is Nondumiso Muluga, who is responsible for the legal unit, as well as Madam Esther Maluleke, who is the program manager responsible for the implementation of the National Strategic Plan. What I'm going to do, Chairperson, I will immediately hand over to her and will not go through the opening remarks that were prepared on behalf of the Director General and the Minister. If there is need for me to cross-reference to those opening remarks, I will certainly do so. But towards the end, I will also highlight some of the challenges that we're experiencing and what are some of those mitigation strategies or interventions that we've put in place. I'm requesting that it be flighted, and Madam Esther will then talk us through the presentation. This presentation, whilst it's being flighted, it's based on the annual report that has been recently launched by the President. This gives an account of the work that has been done throughout the period comprising this 1 year period since the launch of the NSP. Thank you, Chairperson. Can it be flighted for us?